What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with author Robert Hoffler. Robert Hoffler is the author of a new book called The Way They Were. Coinciding with the 50th anniversary of The Way We Were, this intriguing and impeccably researched book is the first ever account of the making of the classic film starring Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford, revealing the full story behind its genesis and continued controversies. Its many deleted scenes, which Robert and I talk about, its much anticipated but never filmed sequel, and the real-life romance that inspired this groundbreaking love story of opposites who attract and start breaking up even before they got married. And now I give you Robert Hoffler. Okay, I am here with Robert Hoffler. Robert, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to be speaking with you. I want to discuss certainly your new book, The Way They Were, also your life and career in general. But before we do, please tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, at this particular moment in my career, I'm the theater critic for The Wrap. And over the last 20 years, I started writing books. I was an editor at various magazines and newspapers for about 40 years, Life, Us, Variety. And then about 10 years ago, I wasn't interested in being an editor anymore. So I started writing books and mainly biographies. There was a biography of a Hollywood agent, Henry Wilson, called The Man Who Invented Rock Hudson, which Ryan Murphy kindly borrowed from his Netflix series, Hollywood. Then I did a book called Party Animals, which was about Al Carr, who produced the movie Grease, the Broadway musical, The Casual Fall, and the worst Oscars ever. That was the one with Snow White from 1989. And, Money, Murder, and Dominic Dunn, Vanity Fair writer who covered all the murder trials, OJ, yeah, the Menendez brothers. And the book I have now that's out is called The Way They Were, which is about the making of the movie The Way We Were, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year.
Excellent. Thank you, Robert. I appreciate that. And The Wrap, I believe that's Sharon Waxman's outlet,
yes.
Correct?
Yes. It's the only independent voice in Hollywood. All the other ones are owned by one person.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Whom I used to work for.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask this question, then we'll move on. But do you have any advice or words of wisdom for the prospective writer?
Don't give up. And you never know what people are going to want. I know that The Way They Were was not an easy sell for my agent. And it's very gratifying for me to watch it. Its numbers on Amazon.com because it's selling a lot better than a book, than a lot of books put out by Random House, Simon & Schuster, and all of them rejected the book.
Hmm. Wonderful. No, I'm happy for you, Robert.
And it's also gotten good reviews, particularly from AP, Publishers Weekly, and The Washington Post.
What was it that prompted you to write the book The Way They Were?
The Way We Were was written by Arthur Lawrence. He wrote the screenplay.
Right.
And most people might, you know, they know The Way We Were, and he also wrote The Turning Point. He also wrote the Alfred Hitchcock movie Rope, which was about the Leopold Loeb murder case of the 1920s, where these two men killed someone just for the fun of it. And that was a shocking case, I think, from 1925 or 27. And anyway, that was Rope. That was his first movie. And he wrote some other screenplays, but he's most famous on Broadway for writing the books for Gypsy and West Side Story. And Arthur Lawrence had three memoirs, two of whom were published by Knopf. And I knew that a lot of the stuff he wrote in those memoirs was false. He was a great fabulist. He was a great storyteller. He was a great liar. But I also knew that no publisher was going to buy a biography on Arthur Lawrence. So I kind of used The Way We Were to look at his own life because it's a little complicated, because when the movie was released in 1973, he said that the Barbara Streisand character, Kitty Morosky, was based on a woman he knew in college who was the president of the Communist League. But later on in his life, he said that the female character was really based on himself. And he told me that. I used to be the theater reporter for Variety, and I got to know him. And I had asked him, was Katie and Hubble, Katie is Jewish radical ex-communist, and Hubble Gardner is the blonde, gorgeous, athletic screenwriter. I said, was that really based on you and Tom Hatcher? And that he had a relationship with Tom Hatcher, who's Gentile, gorgeous, athletic type, for 50 years. And I met both of the men, and I asked him at one point, is the way we were really about you and Tom? And he didn't say no. He said, it was about me in college and my ties to the Communist Party, my activism. He never joined the Communist Party, but he passed out a lot of communist literature. And he said it was also about my being blacklisted in Hollywood in the late 40s. Now, doing research for this book, I found out that he really wasn't blacklisted. That was another one of his tall tales. In doing research for it, I have to say that the Katie Hubble story, which is the Barbara Streisand, Robert Redford story in The Way We Were, isn't based on Arthur Lawrence and Tom Hatcher, but it was inspired by that relationship. And it's interesting, Robert Redford never wanted to play the part, and essentially, to make a long story short, did it as a favor to Sidney Pollack and trusted Sidney Pollack that he would rewrite the role to his satisfaction. Before Redford finally said yes, and it was an 8-month process to get him to say yes, Barbara Streisand was dating Warren Beatty, and she tried to get Warren Beatty to take the role. Her first choice was Robert Redford, but her second choice was Warren Beatty. And if Warren Beatty would have taken the role, I think my book probably would have seen the romance more inspired by Arthur Lawrence's 5-year relationship with movie star Farley Granger. They met on the set of Rope. And of course, Farley Granger went on to make Strangers on a Train and other big movies. But, you know, Robert Redford and Tom Hatcher are both blonde and gorgeous and Gentile, and Warren Beatty and Farley Granger are gorgeous brunette Gentiles. So I think what Arthur Lawrence, that basically the Katie Morosky character is himself, but the Katie Morosky character also has a fatal flaw, which is falling in love with the vapid, gorgeous Gentile jock. And that was also Lawrence's kind of Achilles heel, although he probably wouldn't have seen it that way. All of his affairs, all of his romantic relationships were gorgeous, Gentile men. And when he wrote about these men, the major thing he wrote about is that they were gorgeous. He didn't write about them being, you know, intellectual or politically involved, or that he basically wrote about them as being Ken dolls. And the problem that Robert Redford had with the Hubble character in Arthur Lawrence's original script is that it was a Ken doll.
Right.
He didn't want to play a Ken doll. So two other writers were brought into the process. That was Alvin Sargent, who won an Oscar for writing the screenplay to Ordinary People, which of course was Robert Redford's directorial movie debut. And also David Raphael, who went on to be a very highly paid rewriter of scripts. He was like a script doctor. I don't think he really had that many credits, but he was always like, oh, we've got trouble with this script. And particularly with Sidney Pollack movies, he worked on every Sidney Pollack movie, making little rewrites and improving the script. And neither of those men got credit. The credit went to Arthur Lawrence, but a great deal of the movie, particularly the Hubble character, was written by Sargent and Raphael.
Wow, that's fascinating, Robert. Thank you so much. The book is clearly vigorously researched. I'd love to know what the research process was like. What information did you draw upon?
Well, first off, I had I had approval from no estate. Sometimes that works to your favor, because generally approval from a state means that they have approval of what you write. Now, some writers are able to just not have that, but that wasn't the case. And Arthur Lawrence's estate, which is basically controlled by the William Morris Agency, wanted nothing to do with this. But there was nothing to prevent me from going to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., which has the archives. And I don't know how interested you are in, you know, the rights that you have if you don't have approval from the estate. Facts are not copyrightable. So if someone writes a letter, you can tell the facts of that letter. You can give the date of the letter, who wrote it, to whom. You just can't quote from it. But you can quote a few words. And it's always very much up in the air how many words you could take. So I would take a couple of words just to let people know, well, this is really from this letter written on January 5th of 1957 or something like that. There was one such letter I found between Barbara Streisand and Arthur Lawrence that was, she wrote out in longhand, and it was in pencil, written in 1963. And she had asked for advice on her first album. And he told her that she had copied his friend Lena Horne. Mm-hmm. And she said that his advice was meant to hurt her, not help her. But a lot of it was in the Library of Congress. There were all of these memos I found in the Academy Library in Beverly Hills at the Mark Herrick Library, that there were many letters between Sidney Pollack and the producer, Ray Starr. And they were exchanging letters and memos almost on a daily basis during the filming of the movie. So it was like I was in the room with them, even though they were rarely in the room, because Ray Stark only visited the set once very early in the production and then never went back to it. But while he was watching the rushes, he was constantly complaining about it. And then there were also a lot of letters between Lawrence and whatever. And there were also memos between Sidney Pollack and Robert Redford trying to convince him to do the movie and why Redford didn't like the script.
Yeah. You know, you may have already answered it, Robert, with your comment about the Arthur Lawrence screenplay, but I'm curious, was there anything else that specifically drew you to The Way We Were as a subject matter?
Well, you know, I remember when I first saw the movie, it was Christmas Eve, 1973, and I was going to NYU, and I'm from Iowa, and it was the first Christmas I spent away from my family. So I remember that very distinctly. But I was very interested in the movie even way back then, because my parents were politically very conservative. In fact, they were a little wacko. And I always believed that they supported Senator Joe McCarthy and his, you know, communist witch hunt. And so I was very interested in that. And I was at a process that I went from being their conservative son to their outcast liberal son. And so I was very interested in the movie because of that from the get-go. Then I became an entertainment editor, and I'd heard all these stories that an hour of the movie had been cut out, most of it having to do with the blacklist. And in 1995, I was interviewing Sidney Pollack for his movie Sabrina, which was a big dud. And it was before the movie was released, and it was obvious he knew the movie was a dud. And so he didn't have a lot to say about it. And so I said, do you mind if we talk about The Way We Were and they shoot horses, don't they? And he was, sure, go ahead. So I asked him about all that was cut out of it. And he told me most of what was cut out of it had to do with the blacklist and the House on Un-American Activities. And he said, those scenes didn't work. And there will not be a director's cut of the movie. And he was adamant about it. What I did not know is that over the years and to this day, Barbara Streisand has tried to put back two scenes into the movie, and they have to do with the blacklist. I don't know if she's going to be successful, because I spoke to Pollack's daughters. He has two daughters, and it was my impression that they wanted to respect their father's final cut. Do you want to know what those two scenes are?
By all means, please. Okay. I'd love to.
Well, anyway, Hubble and Katie, you know that they met in college, but they didn't date. And then they met unexpectedly in New York City during World War II, and she invites him back to her apartment, but somehow they regroup, and then they fall in love, and he's a screenwriter, and they move to Hollywood, and she really gives up her entire political past, which had been a communist, and later she was a big FDR. In Hollywood, it's 1947, and that was the beginning of the blacklist in Hollywood. And she becomes very politically involved again in the blacklist, even though Hubble is not blacklisted. And that upsets Hubble because he feels she's putting her political beliefs over his career and their marriage. And then they break up, and then they meet, you know, 5 years later in 1952, and they say goodbye to each other again in front of the Plaza Hotel. The scenes that were cut out have to do with Katie has disobeyed Hubble and has gone to Washington, D.C. to protest the House on Un-American Activities. And that was based on a real Hollywood case called the Thought Control Conferences, which were founded by the director John Huston, who in the movie is the Patrick O'Neill character, Director Bissinger. I forget his first name now. And Humphrey Bogart, Gene Kelly, Danny Kaye, and Lauren Bacall, and Katharine Hepburn became very involved in that, and they all went to Washington, D.C. But when they went to Washington, D.C., and this is what you just hear about in the movie, is that they were embarrassed by the Hollywood tent. Those were the screenwriters who were blacklisted because they were ex-communist, and they were embarrassed by them because they got into cat fights with the U.S. representatives, and there were other reasons they were upset about it. But they came back to Los Angeles, Humphrey Bogart, and they all had to kind of say they had made a mistake, and they were forced into it mainly by Jack Warner from Warner Brothers, because Huston and Bogart had the movie The Treasure of Sierra Madre. And he didn't want anything to upset the release of this big movie. Now, in the movie, the way we were, Katie comes back with Bissinger in Union Square in Los Angeles. And Hubble is there to greet her. And someone calls Katie a communist. And Hubble, you know, hits him. And, you know, then they have this big talk about basically she's putting her politics over their personal life. And in a way, Katie takes the short view of, like, this is important today. And Hubble says, you know, 10 years from now, these blacklisted writers are going to be hired by the producers who are blacklisting. Of course, which is actually what happened. Arthur Lawrence didn't write that scene. That was the scene that Robert Redford wanted so that Hubble didn't come off as a Ken doll. Anyway, around that scene, there's obviously trouble in the marriage, and that's when Hubble has a one-night affair with Carol Ann, and that's the Lois Childs character. Around that time, Katie is pregnant, and she's driving across the UCLA campus, and she sees a young poet who reminds herself of 10 years earlier when she was speaking out against Franco in Spain. This young poet is speaking out against the blacklist in UAC, and it reminds her. And what the scene, even though Streisand doesn't have any words, it leads you to believe Katie gave up too much by falling in love with the gorgeous fantasy wasp. And Jews have a name for that. That's a shagetz. You know what a shiksa is? Mm-hmm. Well, a shagetz is the male six. anyway, this is something I learned writing this book. That's one scene she wanted to put back in. And basically, Pollock found the scene corny. He said it was too head on. The other bigger scene was, you know, the scene in after he's had the affair with Lois Childs. And it's only a one night stand. In the original screenplay, Lawrence had, it was an affair that went on for years. So that was something else they did to make the Redford, the Hubble character, more sympathetic. they're in their cottage. She's very pregnant. And he says, how did you find out about my affair with Carol Ann? And she says, well, it's a friendly town. And he says something to the effect, well, I have news for you too. Freddie McVeigh, that's the James Woods character who was her communist comrade in college, has informed on you to Hua. And she says, well, so what? I'm nobody. And he says, yes, but you're married to me and I can't have an ex-communist wife. And she says, well, I'll divorce you. And he says, well, that won't settle anything. But obviously he decides to let her go ahead with the divorce. But then she says, stay with me till the baby is born. Now, stay with me until the baby is born is still in the movie. And Streisand and Arthur Lawrence felt that's where the romance and the politics came together. And Sidney Pollack took it out because he wanted a clearer, just a faster way to get to the end of the movie. Now, Streisand told me she wants the scene back in because the way the movie plays now, it's like Katie is leaving Hubble because he, in Streisand's word, stooped Carol Ann. I honestly don't agree with her. I think he stooped Carol Ann because he had already felt the movie, the marriage was over. His feeling was she has betrayed me by going to Washington, D.C. She's back on the barricade. She's back being politically active again. She's jeopardizing my career. And that's why he sleeps with her, because in his mind, the marriage is already over. So in a weird sort of way, I can see both sides. And what happened with the movie, the editor told me that, you know, an hour of the movie of the blocklist was taken out. The movie was released in November of 1973. They really did their first major cut of the movie in March of 1972. And John Burnett, who edited the movie, said the movie became about the blacklist. And it became about these characters who were the Humphrey Bogarts of the John Hustons, whatever. And all we needed is for Katie to have another cause. Franco was her cause in the 30s. In the 40s, it was the blacklist. In the 50s, it was ban the bomb. It didn't matter what the cause was. She just had to have a cause. Sidney Pollack, though, thought it created a faster line to get rid of that. But what happened, I'm sorry, I got a little confused.
No problem.
That's when they cut an hour of the movie. But Ray Stark, in September, they had two screenings in New York. One was on a Friday night. One was on a Saturday night. And the movie was 2 hours and 11 minutes. And he wanted it to be 2 hours. And on Friday night, they showed it. And this movie did not play well at 2 hours and 11 minutes. So on Saturday, John Burnett and Sidney Pollack cut 11 minutes out of the movie. And then on Saturday night, they felt they had a hit. The audience loved the movie. Those 11 minutes that are cut out, you can see if you want to buy the 25th anniversary DVD of The Way We Were, in the special features section, there is a documentary called Looking Back. And it has those 11 minutes plus Streisand and Lawrence and Sidney Pollack talking about why they cut it or whatever. So it's very interesting. There are some lovely scenes that were cut out. I'm a little surprised they didn't have a third preview and maybe put back in, you know, the 3 minutes Streisand wanted. And to an extent, I kind of take Streisand. She's known for being very controlling.
Right.
Let's say the movie got made because of her. I mean, of course, it would have got made if Arthur Lawrence had written the thing. But Ray Stark was the producer and he had Streisand under contract. And she said, yes. They were going to make it without Sidney Pollack and Robert Redford. In fact, the one person who was the fallback was Ryan O'Neill.
Interesting. Very interesting, Robert. Thank you. Boy, I tell you, burning through the questions quickly. It's great. I'd love to know, when you were researching for the book, Robert, was there anything in particular that surprised you, that jumped out at you?
Well, I was very happy to get interviews with James Woods and Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford. So that helped a lot. But with Streisand and Redford, I wasn't able to ask them absolutely everything I wanted. I mean, there were parameters on the interview and time limits, all of this stuff. I was really surprised how important it is to this day for Streisand that those two scenes be put back in. It seems to almost have been like a calling. And even her she's now passed away, but one of her big agents, Sue Mangers, you know, was at a party with her once. Streisand just kept going on and on about the way we were and the two seats. She says, when do we get to the Isle of the Pussycat? Like it had become like kind of, and even Sidney Pollack talked about it was a real thing with Streisand. And so there were things with Redford that were strange to me, and I never got an answer on this from him. There is a second love scene in New York City in front of a fireplace. And at the end of that scene, which now in the movie kind of dissolves in them running around New York City, you know, they're here, they're there. It's just them kind of one of those movie montages where they're in love, Central Park. But the scene was supposed to end with him saying, you know, in front of the fireplace, it'll be better this time. And he refused to say it. And it was this huge fight between Ray Stark and Sidney Pollack, because Sidney Pollack also thought it was an important line to say until he realized his good friend Redford wasn't going to say it. And then he was going like, oh, it's not important. And Ray Stark flipped out over that. And I don't know, this is just speculation on my part, but it could very well be that, you know, Robert Redford is never bad at bed. And also there was a line at the end of the movie, you know, Katie has this gesture throughout the movie of taking his bangs and taking her fingernails over his bangs. And at the very end of the movie, she does it and he's supposed to say gray, like he has gray hair. And I found the script and it was crossed out. The other thing that Streisand had to fight for, which I found very interesting, and you will appreciate this with your name, at the end of the movie, she says to him, come meet my husband. She says, call us. It's David X. Cohen. And he says, what's the X for? And she says, it's the only one in the book. Streisand and Ray Stark had to fight to keep that line in the movie that Sidney Pollack wanted to take him out.
Why was that?
I don't know why, but it was a big fight. And of course, I think it's very interesting if they would have taken that out because, you know, at the end of the movie, she has curly hair again. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's kind of an obvious thing. She's gone back to her heritage or I don't know, whatever you want to call it. But it also is very interesting because she doesn't say, oh, call me. The name is in the book, Bob Jones. You know, it's right. David X. Cohen. And I think it indicates that she realized she made a mistake. She gave up too much. And an interesting thing about the movie is the editor told me, he's in his 90s now. He said, you know, an interesting thing about the movie is whenever I give people my resume, the men always say the same thing. Oh, I don't like The Way We Were, but it's my wife's favorite movie. Movie that I think was really more than that. There really is a gender divide on it, but there was with it also. It's one of the few movies we're so used to average looking guys in the movies ending up with the total goddess.
Right.
Now, it's Humphrey Bogart, Jimmy Stewart, Woody Allen, Ben Stiller,
Adam Sandler,
Larry David, you know, whatever, Jerry Seinfeld. But it's really a reverse that the pretty one is the god. And I think a lot of men have problems with it, where women loved it. I mean, women just, you know, bring it on. But the movie is pretty unique. I mean, one of the few other times I can think of it, I think it kind of shows up again in Dirty Dancing, kind of say that with Patrick Swayze. And I found it very true in the TV series Girls that Lena Dunham had one episode where she has a weekend affair with Patrick Wilson. And
right.
It's just like a total fantasy thing. And it's always, we kind of think, oh, it's okay for men because the woman's falling in love with his intelligence, his power, his money, his whatever. But, you know, it's the other way around. It's always about the guy is falling in love with her beauty. And what I do really like about the scene, you know, the David X. Cohen, is that she realizes she made a mistake falling in love with the Baphomet Gentile.
Very interesting, Robert. Thank you. I should probably make sure I ask, where can people pick up the book, Robert?
Well, Amazon.com, I imagine any bookstore, Barnes & Noble. I always go on to Amazon.com to see how it's doing.
Wherever books are sold, as they say, right?
Yes, exactly.
Is there anything else that you're currently working on, Robert? They'd like to tell us?
No, I'm not working on something right now. You know, but if something comes along, you know, with this movie, there were two big secrets that I wanted, and I wanted to answer them for myself. And it was, you know, all of this footage that was cut out of it and whether, you know, a better movie could have been made if some of that was found. I mean, certainly with Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, they found some footage, they put it in, they did it better. I don't know if you're very acquainted with the restoration they did on the 1954 Judy Garland, A Star Is Born, but I think all of that stuff that they cut out should be cut out. And I'm in a minority on that, but I'm just going like, you don't care that James Mason is looking for her. You just want her to become a star. He, you know, goes on the skid. So I don't always think putting stuff in the movie necessarily makes it better. And one of the nice things about researching this book, as opposed to my other books, is that I found that there were five very smart people working on something. And while they were in strong disagreement, I felt Redford, Streisand, Pollock, Lawrence, and Ray Stark were smart people. I understood where they were coming from.
Yeah, absolutely, Robert. Brilliant. Robert Hoffler, how can people find out about you, sir?
RobertHoffler.com. The other books are there. And then also, you know, if you go on to that, or then I have theater reviews. I do over 100 theater reviews a year for The Wrap. So Robert Hoffler and The Wrap, and then you follow all my theater writing.
Excellent. Robert, this was such a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time for me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. You take care, Robert.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.